بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه. Continuing with our reading of Imam al-Nawawi's book, The Maqasid. Inshallah, in today's class, we will begin with the chapter of Zakah. قال المصنف رحمه الله ونفعنا بعلومه في الدارين آمين. So Imam al-Nawawi رحمه الله, may Allah have mercy on him and may we benefit from his knowledge in the two worlds. He says, when is zakah obligatory? Zakah is obligatory for every free Muslim on, and these are the categories of zakah, camels and cattle and sheep or goats. So all of that together is called livestock. So the first category of zakah is livestock. And when one has possessed a zakat payable number, this is called an-nisab. An-nisab is the minimal zakatable amount. So throughout the different categories of zakat, we are going to learn that each category has a limit, a minimal zakatable amount, meaning if you have possession of below that amount, you're not going to pay zakat. So on money, for example, you don't pay zakat no matter how much money you have. You have to have a certain amount and above. And the second condition, or the third condition, is that you have them for a full lunar year. This is called al-hawl. Al-hawl is the lunar year. Of course, the calendar of the Sharia is the lunar calendar, which is about 11 days shorter than the solar calendar. You have to have them for a full lunar year. They have to have been grazing them on unowned open range for the entire year. That's a condition specific, obviously, to livestock, which probably most of us don't have. The next category is gold and silver or money, because here what is meant is money, not, but the money or the currency of the Sharia is gold and silver. So you can't read about what Islam says about money, finance, business transactions, unless you learn about gold and silver. Or in addition to that, and as well, we should say, and that in addition, sorry, or money. So you have to pay zakat on money. But let us just read it the way it is in the traditional text. On gold and silver, other than that is jewelry that is permissible for use. So in the Shafi'i madhab, a woman's jewelry is not zakatable. So you pay on gold and silver, not on jewelry. The reason he mentions jewelry is that usually jewelry is gold and silver, but not always. And you also have to pay on trade goods. Trade goods or trading means that you buy something with the intent of holding it and selling that same thing for a profit. That's trading. If I buy something and I process it, I package it, and I form something else, and I'm manufacturing, there is no zakat on the manufacturing process. It's only on trade. You do this when one has possessed the minimal zakatable amount. The third category is on staple food crops. As soon as one possesses a zakatable payable amount of grains and legumes. So when it comes to the crops, the nisab, the minimal zakatable amount, as he will say shortly, is a weight. The minute you hit that weight, you pay the zakat immediately. You don't hold it for a year. Why? Because the grains will spoil. You're not going to hold it. The point is to consume it or to sell it. So you pay, another way of thinking about it is you pay once per harvest. So if you have two harvests in 1 year, you're only going to pay one zakat, not double, because it's rare to have two harvests. So you pay per harvest. If you have multiple crops that have different harvesting schedules, you don't commingle the crops. Rather, you isolate each crop. At its harvest time, if you've hit the nisab of that crop, then you pay the zakat. So you pay on grains, legumes, raw dates, and grapes. So it's agricultural goods and fruit. The only two fruit that the Sharia is concerned with for zakat purposes are dates and grapes when they dried, i.e. raisins. There's no zakat on the vegetables and the like. Okay, now going back over the categories, what is the zakat on the livestock? The minimum number of camels on which zakat is payable is 5. And then there's an intricate calculation more than five that Sheikh Nuh didn't translate, because it's not really for a beginner, and we'll just leave it at that. When we talk next week about the Matn of Abi Shuja, we will get into that exactly in detail. The minimum number of cattle on which zakah is payable is 30 head, for which it is obligatory to give a yearling. The zakat due on 40, so that was 30. If you have 40, then you're going to give 2-year-old female that has entered its third year, and so on and so forth. The minimum number of sheep and goats on which zakat is payable is 40, on which it is obligatory to pay a share, which is either a 1 year old, which is either a 1-year-old sheep or a 2-year-old goat. The zakat on 121 sheep or goats is 2 share. If you have 201 sheep or goats, you pay 3. And for every additional 100, the zakat is 1 share. So these are just things you have to memorize, or you make a table if you're a farmer, and you just keep that front and center. Okay. Zakat on gold and silver or other money. What is the minimal zakatable amount on gold? It's 85 grams of 21 karat gold. Meaning two things. One is that if you actually have gold and you weigh it and it's 85 grams or more, then you have reached one condition. You have to hold that for a year, and then you will pay 2.5% on that. Or if you have the dollar amount or the money amount of 85 grams of 21 karat gold. Why 21 karat gold? Because the gold dinars that were in circulation at the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when the ulama came to analyze them, they were 21 karat gold. So that is the basis for the monetary value for zakat. So we use as a calculation, if you have money, you wonder how much money do I need to have in excess of to pay to start considering paying zakat. You will find the dollar. Let's just go with the dollar because it's the world reserve currency. What is 85 grams of 21 karat gold worth today in a dollar amount? Today, at the time of this recording, it's, I think I calculated it over, before Ramadan, because I had a class on zakat. In March of 2023, it was $5,767.41. So let's say $5,700. That's the nisab, meaning if you have that and more, you have nisab. If you hold that for a year and it doesn't go below that, then you're going to pay 2.5% of that. For silver, the nisab is 592.9 grams of silver, on which you pay 2.5%. Now, why do we use the dollar? Why do we use the gold for the criteria for zakat on money, not silver? Because the threshold is a little bit higher. Silver, 592.9 grams, is very low in a dollar amount, which would mean that almost everyone that has any kind of money would pay zakat, which would be not fair, because many of these people they need that money. It's not really not excess. The point of zakat is that you're paying a zakat on excess unused money. Okay, there's no zakat on jewelry, gold and silver, halal gold and silver jewelry. Halal meaning, like, if I had gold jewelry, it's haram for a man, I would have to pay zakat on that. But my wife, gold, silver stuff, she doesn't have to pay zakat, which is a difference from the Hanafi method. An immediate zakat of 20% is due when one finds gold or silver treasure. So if you're a treasure hunter and you get your gold and silver, immediately you're going to pay 20% zakat. As for the crops, the minimal quantity on which zakat is payable for crops is 609 kilograms of net dry weight, meaning that you have to remove the husk, the water of the grape goes, that's why I said the grape goes, that's why it's a raisin, because when you have water and the outer husk and the shell, that adds weight to the thing, to the thing that you're weighing. So you have to devoid it of all of that, and then the net result after that, if you hit 609 kilograms and above, you've had your nisab. What is the zakat that you pay? 10% of that. If all of that was watered without effort, it's just natural, Allah water. But if you had a hand in it. More than 50% of the land or the crops were watered or irrigated through human intervention. The zakat you're going to pay is 5%. How about trade goods? Trade goods are appraised at the end of the year in terms of the type of money they were purchased with. And if this reaches the zakat minimal of gold, one pays 2.5% on them. Meaning, first of all, when you buy inventory, if you're trading, you are going to see at the end of the year how much your inventory is worth using the currency you use to buy that with. So if you bought it in euros, then you see the value in euros. If you buy it in yen, then you see the value in yen. If you buy it in dollars, and at the end of the year, you see it in dollars. If that dollar amount is above the nisab for money, which we said is 85 grams of 21 karat gold, then you're going to pay 2.5 zakat on that. Money-wise, meaning you don't take the inventory and give the inventory 2.5% of it in zakat. You have to convert that into money. So if you don't have cash, the cash equivalency, you will sell some of the inventory to get the cash amount and pay that in zakat. And then stocks. If you own stocks, stocks are considered arud al-tijara. They're considered trade goods because you buy the stock, holding it, trying to let it increase in value and then selling it. Okay, then there's another type of zakat, as we know, called zakat al-fitr, which we pay in Ramadan. Zakat al-fitr consists of the modern way of saying it is 2.5 kilograms of staple food. If the main staple is bread, as in many countries, only wheat may be given, and is what is meant by the expression giving food here and in all texts. Meaning, well, let me just elaborate on that because that's a little bit unclear. What are the staple foods? The staple foods vary. It could be rice, could be beans, could be raisins, could be wheat, barley. Every country, every region has different staple foods. And in addition, all of those things I mentioned, they're all worth different things. So zakat al-fitr technically is a range. You could pick the cheapest staple food and give the money amount of 2.5 kilograms, or you can take the most expensive one and there'd be, you know, several dozens of dollars in between discrepancy. What do you do? Usually a fiqh body, a mosque body, an organization would determine that amount for the community. Either they would give it as a range or they would take the average, you know, or the middle staple food, etc. Well, let me just summarize the section because there's so much that he added, it's hard to read. So the other condition is that zakat al-fitr is paid if you're a Muslim, obviously, and on a Muslim headcount in the house. So if I have non-Muslims in my family that I'm responsible for, I don't count them into the number of people I have to pay zakat al-fitr for. So in my case, like my wife and my children or elderly parents, I'm taking care of those people. I'm obligated by the Sharia to support. So I count, if I have like seven people, then let's say the zakat al-fitr this year is $10. I do 10 times 50. I got to pay $50 zakat al-fitr. As long as I have enough to cover my needs and my family's needs on the evening of the Eid prayer. That's when you have to give it. You have to give it before Salat al-Eid, but you can give it beginning with the first night of Ramadan. That's the permissible time, but it becomes obligatory, meaning that you sin if you don't give it, once you hit Maghrib of the last day of Ramadan, up until before the Eid prayer the following day. Okay, who gets the zakat? Who do we distribute the zakat to? Zakat is distributed among eight categories and recipients, or those of them who are found. The eight categories are, this is a directly from verse number 60 in Surah At-Tawbah. The first is al-fuqara, the poor. The poor, and then the next category is al-masakeen, the needy. In the Shafi'i madhab, the poor person is the person that needs, for example, 100 every month and they only have 10. The needy person is the person that needs 100 every month and they have 80. So the needy has a little bit more then the poor but is falling short. The poor has less than half of what they need. And in some of the other madhahibs, it's the same definition but reversed. What we define as the needy is their definition of the poor, and what we define as the poor is their definition of the needy. But it's just the same mental categories are the same. That's what the poor and the needy mean. الفقراء والمساكين والعاملين عليها. العاملين عليها are the zakah workers, those who collect the zakah and distribute the zakah in the case that you yourself are not giving the zakah. So if I'm distributing my own zakah, I'm not considered a zakah worker. I can give myself zakah, obviously. So that category would fall. But if there was a collection agency, a zakah collection agency, and you know, almost usually that's how we give our zakah, then that zakah collection body can cover its overhead expenses through the zakah itself, because that's one of the categories. Because you have to understand, zakah is not just money. It's also livestock, it's agricultural goods. So there's stuff, it's not just money, there's a lot of assets. And everybody has a different calendar, a zakah calendar, because maybe I got $10,000 today in the middle of whatever we are in May, the beginning of May. But maybe you get $10,000 later in the summer. So your year is different than my year. So if you think about the zakah or Baytul Mal, it's receiving money and stuff almost every week from all sorts of different people. Excuse me. So distributing it is a full-time job. So if you have a sophisticated operation like that, al-amilina alayhim. Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina Muhammad. Wal-mu'allafatu qulubuhum. And those whose hearts are to be reconciled, meaning those, and this category is for the government to determine, not individuals. Those are people who have become Muslim, but they are a leader in their area. And by supporting them financially with zakah, it is hoped that more people would become Muslim. Or somebody who, like a neighboring city or tribe or group of people have become Muslim, but their iman is weak. And we know that if we support them financially through the zakah money, that will help strengthen their iman. Iman. From a state perspective, of course, if there is a neighboring hostile nation, and rather than fighting that nation all right out, we can give the zakah to people who are under our auspices or control from the zakah money, and they can do the fighting or the defending on our behalf. In other words, all of the categories of the eight categories of zakah are Muslim. It's impermissible, it's haram to give zakah money to non-Muslims in our madhab. So this category, and I'm highlighting this because this is a common misconception that Muslims have, the mu'allafatu qulubum are not people that are not Muslim and we think if we give them, we're bribing them to become Muslim. That's ridiculous. That's not what it means. These are all types of Muslims, and I just gave you three types. I think in the longer books of fiqh, there's like five or six, you know, other subtypes. Those are bondsmen, people who are buying their freedom. Alhamdulillah, we don't have slavery anymore. There's no international slave trade, but there is still slavery, of course. And, you know, if you come across somebody who's in bondage of some sort, using the zakah to free that person would be permissible. What does it mean? Those who are in debt. So those who are in debt, alhamdulillah, in America, we don't have a debtor's jail anymore. But in some countries, there are people that are in jail for debt, and many of them, unfortunately, are women because, you know, the men skedaddle and leave the women, you know, the short end of the stick. And, you know, unfortunately, in many Muslim countries, you'll find a debtor's jail that has, you know, haram women and they have children. It's just those people can be freed from their debt through the zakah money. What is sabil? The traveler, you know, the person who was traveling and needed money to get home. Afwan, before Ibn Sabil is wafi sabilillah wa ibn sabil. Wafi sabilillah, in the cause of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, means those who are fighting a legitimate war, a legitimate jihad, meaning that it's under a duly constituted state, Islamic state, has declared war for the purposes of protecting and defending Islam, not for the purposes of extending our trade, you know, influence or some other type of thing. Is a pure type of thing. The idea is that many nations in the pre-modern world didn't have standing armies, professional armies. So you had to use this zakah money to equip the army. Now, fi sabilillah, some of the Salaf argued that there are different types of fighting. You can fight bis-sinan, you can fight with weapons, or you can fight bil-lisan, with your tongue. And this was the position of Al-Qaffal, rahimahullah, one of the early jurists. So based on that, there are many modern opinions by, you know, legitimate fuqaha and fatwa bodies that if there are institutions or organizations that are defending and protecting Islam and defending our summa, our reputation, things like that, that would be fi sabilillah. Now, obviously, this is abused by almost every single organization. So you have any organization, and they're like, oh, we're zakat eligible. And so I caution against that because I'm a little bit conservative personally when it comes to this. You have to be careful. It exists in the fiqh. You can't deny it. That is a correct interpretation. I can't deny that opinion exists. But we also can't abuse it. It has to be something that is essential. And then, وَبِنِ السَّبِيلِ, the person who is traveling and can't get home. Then he says on the bottom of page 78, the least that fulfills the obligation of zakah is to give it to three individuals for each category. So in other words, you should try to make an effort to give it to at least three categories and at least three people in each category. So, which is why sometimes it's difficult to give zakah directly. Usually we give it to a zakah organization and then they distribute it, because they'll have applications, people will apply, or they'll know of people that need it, etc. And then lastly, he says, it is not permissible to give zakat to a non-Muslim or to give from the share of the poor to anyone who has enough of their needs, whether through owning or being able to earn it. Okay, fasting. Fasting Ramadan is obligatory for every Muslim who is morally responsible, meaning is of mature age, rational, can understand. Fasting is only valid if you make the intention. So in the Shafi'i Madhab, and it has to be made in the night prior. So in the Shafi'i Madhab, to fast a fard fast, a fard of Ramadan, or if you're making up a fard fast, you have to have the intention before Salatul Fajr of the day that you're fasting, the night before. So in the Shafi'i Madhab, the way we were taught is that when you break your fast in Ramadan, you know, Allahumma laka sumtu ala rizqa qiftart, dhahab al-atash, thabat al-ajr, inshallah, you're biting into your day. Then you say, nuwaitu siyam ghadan min Ramadan, I intend to fast tomorrow Ramadan, and then you drink or you eat your day. So it's like a Shafi'i custom. Even when we teach my children, it's just, that's how we say it. It's like part of the breaking fast dua to ensure that you have the intention to fast the next day. Also, for the fast to be valid, it says nothing that breaks the fast occurs, including leaving Islam. I mean, if you leave Islam in the middle of fasting, you have other things you got to worry about, bigger than the fast. A woman being in her period or menstruation or postnatal bleeding, deliberate vomiting. Why deliberate vomiting? We'll get back to that in a second. Sexual intercourse, masturbation, a substance in a passageway reaching the body cavity, such as the stomach, the inner ear, the rectum, or the bladder. Okay, let me state that in an easier way. Anything that enters the body cavity breaks the fast. The entrance of the body cavity in the Shafi'i Madhab is the ear, the nose, the mouth, the penis, vagina, and anus, and veins and arteries. So why does he say vomit, intentional vomiting? Because intentional vomiting means I put my finger in the back of my throat. So I've put something inside the body cavity that's outside. So when you fast, you are fasting withholding things entering the body cavity. So if you had a stick, and these are just gross examples, but if you had a stick and you jammed it all the way into your ear, other than the fact that you're going to seriously injure yourself, you've broken your fast. If you put the water up your nose when you're making too much, you break your fast. If you take a needle into the vein, either to draw blood or an IV, that breaks your fast. But the muscle, an intramuscular shot, like an insulin shot, or just like a, you know, shot that they that's put like in your shoulder, that doesn't break your fast because that's not considered by the fuqaha the body cavity. That's why he mentioned these things. So anything that enters the body cavity is one category that breaks your fast. Any sexual activity of penetration and or masturbation breaks your fast. And obviously menstruation and postnatal bleeding specific to women breaks your fast. You can't fast during that time. Smoking would break your fast as well. Why? Because the smoke is going in, it's being inhaled, even if unintentionally, and it breaks your fast. Irrespective of some of these things are haram or halal, I'm just explaining to you what's written. Okay. A lot of extras there. We're skipping the extras. Those who are ill, on top of page 82, who doesn't have to fast? Oh, actually, this is all extra. Ma'ul. Well, the summary of these extra things is that obviously if you're sick and traveling, you have the right to break your fast. Sickness in the Sharia has two kinds. Temporary sickness and permanent sickness. May Allah Ta'ala protect us. So temporary sickness, like I got a cold or like a stomach bug, 24, 48 hours, you know, I break my fast for those 2 days. And then after Ramadan, I make them up. Permanent sickness is like old age, you're too frail to fast, you have a permanent medical condition, you can't fast. Obviously, those people are excused, but they won't be able to make up the fasting, so they're going to pay the fidya at some point. Sunnahs of fasting. The sunnahs of fasting include delaying the pre-dawn meal, meaning suhoor, having suhoor as close to fajr as you can, breaking your fast right away, breaking your fast with an odd number of dates, and avoiding bad language and bad behavior throughout the month. What are the days that are unlawful to fast? It is unlawful or it is invalid to fast on the 2 days of Eid, Eid al-Fitr and Eid al-Adha, and the 3 days following Eid al-Adha. So the first of Shawwal, the 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th of Dhul Hijjah. It is also unlawful and invalid to fast on the day of uncertainty, which is the 30th of Sha'ban. So the Prophet ﷺ said on the 29th of Sha'ban, you go out and look for the new moon. If you don't see the new moon, then you continue Sha'ban 30 days. If you see the new moon, Sha'ban is 29 days and the next day is Ramadan. So that day, the day of the 30th, they call it Yawm al-Shak, the day of doubt. So some people are like, you know, just in case I'm going to fast today because maybe we saw the moon but we didn't see it, or it's haram to fast that day for us. Okay, violating the fast by sexual intercourse. This is a section because there's a special ruling for that. If you violate a fast day by sexual intercourse, you must make up that day and expiate for it, as one does for injurious comparison, which is something called the dhihar, which is a specific sin that is in the Quran. What is the expiation for that? Is that you have to free a slave. If you cannot free a Muslim slave, well, obviously we don't have, you have to fast 2 consecutive months, 60 days straight. If you can't do that for physical reasons, then you have to feed 60 needy people. So Imam al-Shafi'i, he took that hadith of the man who said that I had intercourse with my wife during Ramadan, and the Prophet ﷺ guided him to the expiation. Imam al-Shafi'i took that expiation as specific to the person who breaks their fast unlawfully in Ramadan through sexual intercourse. How about if you break your fast because I don't feel like fasting today and you eat? I mean, that's other than the fact that it's an enormous sin. Imam al-Shafi'i is saying you've lost something that you almost can't regain. So the only thing that you can possibly do is just make up that day. But there's nothing that you can do to really make up the fact that you just didn't fast. That's how massive of a sin it is. But why the expiation, this elaborate expiation for the intercourse thing? Because of the specific hadith that mentions it. And that's the style, the usul, the approach of the ijtihad of Imam Shafi'i is to look for the specific prima facie verbatim meanings and proof texts when possible. If someone dies with unperformed fast days, which he could have made up but did not, then each fast day is paid for with half of a liter of food. You expiate on their behalf. You can also fast on their behalf. As for someone who dies after two Ramadans elapses upon his missed fast, each day is paid with 1 liter of food. Or the family member can both fast a day and pay 0.5 liters of food for each day. In other words, in the Shafi'i Madhab, if you miss your fasting of Ramadan, like let's say you're sick or you're traveling, he's saying you have to make it up before the next Ramadan. If you don't make it up before the next Ramadan, you still have to make up that day, plus you have to pay the expiation. Other madhahib say you just have to make up the day. There's no expiation. Just make up the day when you can. And that second opinion is the opinion we give women, especially that have not fasted several Ramadans because they're pregnant and nursing and, you know, child stuff. Okay, valid excuses from fasting. It is permissible to omit fasting a day or more of Ramadan if a person is ill or traveling, or is a woman who is pregnant or breastfeeding a baby and apprehends harm to herself. Though if she omits it because of fear of harm for the child, then in addition to making up each day, she must give the 0.5 liters of food in charity for each day missed as an expiation. So if a woman breaks her fast because she's pregnant or breastfeeding because she can't take it, she just has to make up the fast day. If the woman who's breastfeeding or pregnant makes up the day because the doctor tells her it's dangerous for the child, even though she feels like she's able to do it, there's no sin. She makes up the day, but she's going to pay the expiation for that reason. And then lastly, the i'tikaf. Spiritual retreat in the mosque, i'tikaf, is a sunnah, and it is only valid by staying in a mosque with the intention of spiritual retreat. If one vows to make spiritual retreat for a consecutive period, the consecutiveness of such a period is nullified by lovemaking, though not by leaving. Drinking, or to use the lavatory, or because of the onset of menstruation or an illness with which remaining in the mosque presents a hardship. In the Shafi'i madhab, the i'tikaf, of course, it's a sunnah in Ramadan, but it's not linked to fasting the way it is in the Hanafi madhab. So for us, you can make i'tikaf anytime. So if I'm going to go to, after this class, if I go to the mosque and I have an intention for the duration of the time I'm in the mosque, I'm in i'tikaf, I'll get the reward of i'tikaf. But the i'tikaf in Ramadan is something that usually takes place over several days or the last 10 days, which is the sunnah. And you can leave the mosque, like you can go home to change or to use the bathroom or to shower, or if you got to go get something to eat, that doesn't break the i'tikaf. But I can't go, you know, a man can't go home and, or a woman can't go and sleep with their spouse and come back, and that breaks the i'tikaf. It's not a sin, but it's just, it breaks the i'tikaf. That's what he's saying. Or if a woman's in the mosque for i'tikaf and then she gets her period, obviously she has to leave the mosque, but she's going to get the reward of i'tikaf. Or let's say I'm in the mosque doing i'tikaf and I get sick, or I got to go home and grab some medicine. You'll still get the reward, and that doesn't break the i'tikaf. That's what he's saying. Well, before we do Hajj, are there any questions? I think we can do a couple of pages of the Hajj, and then we'll conclude the book tomorrow. So are there any questions so far that people have? Okay. The pilgrimage, the Hajj and Umrah. In the Shafi'i Madhab, it's fard to do Hajj once in your life and Umrah once in your life. So both the Hajj and the Umrah are obligatory, though neither is obligatory more than once in a person's lifetime, unless you vow the Hajj or Umrah is only obligatory when a Muslim who is morally responsible and able to afford provisions and transportation. من استطاع إليه سبيلا, the Prophet said, whoever can and is able to go. So you have to be physically able to go, healthy, able physically to travel, and you have to have the funds to go. You have to take off work or school or whatever your day-to-day, your children are taking care of. You have to have all of that. Once you have that stuff, then that's the obligation falls upon you to go. If you don't have that stuff in order, then it's not an obligation. And that's why it's once in a lifetime. May Allah Ta'ala, you know, write it for all of us, inshallah, and make it easy. The integrals of Hajj are, so the integrals, remember, from the prayer section, are those things without which the act is not valid. Number one is you have to enter into a state of ihram. A state of ihram is you make an intention. The sunnah is to take a bath, a ghusl before. And if you are a man, you have to take off all of your clothes and put on the two white garments. If you are a woman, you have to make sure that your face is not covered and your hands are not covered. So the ihram of the woman is in her face and in her hands. You cannot cut your hair, trim your nails on purpose while you are in a state of ihram. If the male, he says, you shed any garments that have sewing in them, meaning this thobe that I'm wearing, obviously it's, you know, it's stitched. There's stitching all over here. The stitching encompasses my body. And down the side, there's stitching. It's, you know, there's stitching here. The sleeve is encompassed around my arm because of the stitching. But if I took this off and wrapped it around me like a towel, that would count. And that's another misconception that Muslims have, is that the men have, that clothes can't have any stitching in them. No, the stitching cannot enclose itself around you. Now, obviously, I'm not going to take this off and wrap it as a towel. I'm going to get the white, you know, the white towel, ihram clothes, but just so you understand the picture. Somebody's saying, if I save money with the intention that it will be used for Hajj, can I use this money to get married if I fear for my chastity? Yeah, you can. You don't have to save money. Yeah, because the marriage in that case will be more important, because it's an ongoing thing, whereas the Hajj is just once. So the man sheds any garments that have sewing in them, which is, you know, I'd have to look at the original Arabic. That's not exactly right. So your shoes could have stitching. Your shoes could have stitching, but if it closes around your shoe, around your heel and your toes, then it's enclosed your foot. So what you would have to do is you would have to step down on the heel, right? So that the heel is exposed. So, well, I'm not going to bring my shoes into the camera, but like a croc, right? Or like sandals where your heel is exposed. So let's say you had, you know, tennis shoes or, you know, jogging shoes or gym shoes. That's all you had. You step on the heel. The heel part, so the heel is naked, not enclosed. Yes, I say you can use the money to get married. Okay, you shed any garments that have sewing in them, taking them off, blah, blah, blah. All this extra stuff is so hard to read around. That's actually all he says there. Then you put on a clean white mantle for men, and sandals that do not enclose the foot, but rather reveal the toes and the heels. So sorry. So even if you did what I just said, your toes would be encompassed right around your toes and in front of you through the stitching. So that wouldn't work, because you have to have those would have to be exposed as well. I'm sorry about that. As opposed to sandals that covered the toes, for wearing such sandals obliges one to slaughter. Meaning that if you broke your ihram, you're going to have to expiate by slaughtering an animal. It is recommended to perfume the body, though not one's clothes, before you enter into the state of ihram. After you are in the state of ihram for men and women, you can't use any perfume or scented things, which is why when you go to Hajj, they'll give you like non-scented soap, which I find to be the most, that was the oddest thing in my experience. I've never experienced non-scented soap in my life, and I felt like I wasn't cleaning myself. I guess I just got so used to it. The above measures apply to women, equally to women. The women do not divest themselves of sewn garments, obviously. A woman being obliged to cover all her body except her face and hands, which in the ihram, as well as in prayer, are not considered nakedness. But women may not use perfume after, just like men, after you enter the state of ihram. Okay, so the woman can't cover her face and her hands. That's the ihram for her. All the foregoing are done before entering ihram. When one prays two rakahs, provided it is not a time when prayer is forbidden, intending the sunnah of ihram. So there's a two rakah sunnah that you can pray to enter in the state of ihram, that you recite Al-Kafirun in the first one and Surah Ikhlas in the second one. I just realized that all of this is extra, so we'll skip that. Now, B, the next integral is standing on Arafah. The Prophet ﷺ said, Al-Hajju Arafah. Hajj is standing in the plain of Arafah, even if it's for a moment, on the 9th of Dhul-Hijjah. Then going around the Kaaba 7 times, make sure the Kaaba is on your left shoulder. If it's on the right shoulder, you're going the wrong way. And then going between the Safa and the Marwa 7 times, starting with the Safa. So from Safa to Marwa is 1, and then Marwa back to Safa is 2. Alhamdulillah. And then for men, shaving or shortening the hair afterwards at Tahallul, and for women, shorting. It's haram for women to shave their heads unless there's some sickness. So to shorten the hair for the women, the least amount of hair that needs to be cut is 3 hairs. As far as the integrals for Umrah, they are the same, except there's no Arafah. In Umrah, you do everything other than standing in Arafah. And I think we'll stop here. We'll pick up with the obligations. So those are the integrals. If you don't have those things, you've not done Hajj or Umrah. The wajibat, the obligatory things that will come next, if you mess those things up, your Hajj is still valid, but you have to expiate. That's the difference. And then less than that are sunnahs, which are just sunnah acts. We'll get to that tomorrow, and then we will conclude with the section of tasawuf, which I'll try to spend a little bit more time on, inshallah, as it's very beneficial. Wallahu ta'ala a'la wa a'lam wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam. Are there any questions that people have? Could you please go over the timing of raising and lowering the shahada finger again during prayer? So when you come up from sujood, Allahu Akbar, you put your hands on your thighs like this, and then with your right hand, you bring your pinky, ring finger, and middle finger down. You cross over your thumb, and your pointer finger remains like this. So your hand is like this, and then you bring it in. So you're sitting on your thighs like this. At-tahiyyatu lillahi wa salatu tayyibat. As-salamu alayka ayyuha nabi wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu alayna wa ala ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna sayyidina Muhammad Rasulullah. And then you continue all the way to the end with your finger extended but slightly bent until you say as-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah. As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah. How should I handle praying Fajr? Most likely, I wouldn't be off the plane. Well, I think the question might be missing something. But in the Shafi'i Madhab, we do not pray in the plane. Because one of the conditions for the prayer, when you get into the longer books, is that prayer must be conducted, connected to the earth, not suspended in the air. So subhanAllah, even the medieval fuqaha, they thought of that. So if I'm on earth, like now I'm on the ground in a house or a room, or if I'm in a train, or if I'm in a boat, or if I'm in the streets or in the mosque, all of that is I'm connected. But if I'm suspended, like in the plane, it breaches one of the conditions of prayer. So the Shafi'is will say, at the time that you are flying, the obligation to pray is suspended because one of its conditions, like, actually, this is unique because all of the other things you can think of you would pray anyway. So this is one of the unique things. They say that the condition for praying is suspended, and then when you land, you make up the prayers that you missed without incurring any sin. So that's one thing. The other thing is you can't pray unless the time has come in. So if you have a red eye that lands at 5:45 and Fajr ends at 6, how do you handle praying Fajr? You wouldn't be off the plane till after 6. That would be, I've been in that situation many, many, many times, unfortunately. And you just have to catch the prayer the minute you possibly can. Because when you land, you're not allowed to stand because the plane is still in motion as it's taxiing to the gate. And then when you get to the gate, everybody stands up at the same time, so there's no space to pray. So in a way, the conditions are still suspended. You're not able to, you know, and you're not in battle, so you can't just do whatever, like we took the fear prayer, you can't do that. You have to wait till you exit the plane. And if you're lucky enough that you have wudu, you have to know the direction of the Qibla and just pull over to the side and pray. That would be the fastest that you can. And I've, you know, done that many, many times. I've done that so many times that I don't even think about it. I used to be like, well, everyone's thinking what this guy's doing. And you know, so at that point, you have to pray as soon as you possibly can. And inshallah, there's no sin. Inshallah. Questions? Anybody have any other questions? Okay. Tomorrow, inshallah, we will finish the book. What if I spend all the money I earn? Is there zakah? No, because the zakah, the first condition is that you've reached the nisab, the minimal zakatable amount, which a couple months ago was about $5,700? Yeah, 5,767. So once you have the first zakatable amount, the next thing is you have to hold that same amount or more for more than a year. So if I have like $10,000 now, but the next month I spend it all on expenses, there's no zakat because I haven't held it for a year. I think the fiqh, I have not taught this book before because it's not really a teaching book. So when we talk next week on the Waraqah, when we read the Matn of Abi Shuja, that's a teaching book. It's a textbook. It's a beginning, middle, and end book. I mean, I call it an elastic book. You can read it in the beginning of your journey, in the middle of your journey, at the end of your journey. It's the book that keeps giving for Shafi'is. A lot of these details will be ironed out because of the way the book is written. So all of the things that I'm skipping here, because this is an introductory book, inshallah will be clear once we get to next week, bi'idhnillah ta'ala. So I'm sorry if in this course on this particular book, if a lot is lacking. So think of this course, these last few days, as if you've never heard about anything about Islam before, but you're a Muslim or you want to start practicing your faith. This is just giving you the highlights of the basics. So now you have in your mind these categories. Okay, there's prayer. You have to wash before prayer. You have to fast. You have to owe some money sometimes. Once in my life, I got to do this Hajj stuff. That's all you're really going to get from that. But sort of a lot of these derivatives of these questions and these sub-questions, inshallah, will be made clear in next week, bi'idhnillah. Wallahu ta'ala a'la wa a'lam. Wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.